You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome to Literary Treks, TFM's Star Trek books and comics show. I am one of your hosts, KC Pettit, and with me, as he always is Jonathan Cohn. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, it's been very busy. We've not recorded in quite a while, yeah. But we have a great episode talking with James Swallow today.
Yes. Yeah, we'd actually hoped to do this interview a lot sooner, closer to when the book came out, but just with timing and everything, and I'm on the west coast of the U.S., you're on the east coast of the U.S., and James is in the U.K., so lighting that all up can take some time, but yes, very excited for that, and you know, we will get back to the Gateways books next time. But, yeah, and before we jump into everything, we'll tell everybody how to get a hold of us. You can find all of our shows by going to our website, trek.fm. Follow us on X and Instagram at trekfm. And you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. While you're there, join our listeners-only group, the Babel Conference. Just go to the Facebook search field and type B-A-B-E-L, and it should come right up. We also have a dedicated Goodreads group for Literary Treks. Join us there, and you can see the books we've read and even what's coming up next, which is pretty easy because it's just the rest of the Gateways books for now. if you'd like to support the network, which we would really appreciate, please go to patreon.com/trekfm, where you can select from any number of tiers. And if you have a show that you really enjoy, such as Literary Treks, you can be an associate producer like I am and Greg Rosier are for Literary Treks. And lastly, please leave us a star rating and a written review wherever you get your podcasts. It's a great for us to get some feedback and also helps others find the show. Well, we have a little bit of sad news today, and we're not going to do any comics, it's been a rough couple months with Star Trek authors. You know, in our last episode, we had talked about the passing of Margaret Clark, who's been a kind of a preeminent editor for Star Trek books for years and years and years. But we've also lost a couple of authors since we last recorded.
Yeah, we lost Peter Morwood. Who died in May at the age of 68, who was the husband of Diane Duane, and who worked on some Star Trek books like Star Trek number 48, Rules of Engagement. He co-authored Star Trek number 35, Rahansu, The Romulan Way. And so that was really sad news. But we also, sadly, also in May, lost Peter David, who I think most people who have read Star Trek novels know who Peter David is, and also people in the comics business know who Peter David was, because he was very involved in comics as well. But he wrote 48 Star Trek novels in his time, including the New Frontier series, including Imzadi, IQ. He worked on so many more. It was very, very sad. I know he'd been having a lot of health issues over the last decade, but it was very sad losing him.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's actually kind of crazy. Both their names are Peter, and they both were 68 years old. You know, I think, you know, with Peter Morwood, you know, he only wrote a couple, but, you know, people, know of his name and everything. And, you know, and we, you know, I know that, James Swallow also knew him, so he was a good friend of his, but, you know, Diane Duane, I think, is another name that everybody knows. And, you know, and actually, I think last year in 2024, I believe we lost Dave Gallanter, who was the husband of Diane Carey, another, you know, other Star Trek authors. So, I mean, it's tough. I mean, I know that, you know, as we go and how many books that we've gotten over the years, there's, you know, a lot of authors that we've lost, but, you know, the really great thing is that we've got their books to read. And I think, you know, I don't think that we've ever talked about those Rihansu books on, literary treks before, so it might be something to check out, just kind of now it's back on our radar a little bit. You know, they kind of spanned quite a few generations as far as, you know, some of the earlier Star Trek novels, and then, you know, later in the kind of oeuvre of Star Trek novels, they were brought back. But yeah, Peter David, I know we've talked about a lot of his books on literary treks before. I know in Zadi, I think Bruce and Dan had Amy Nelson on to talk about that one. You know, a number of them, and we've never gone through the New Frontier books, but you know, something to consider for the future. Although there's quite a few of those ones, so it might be something to tackle over time. But
we'll have at least one of them.
That's a good
in a few weeks.
That's a good point.
Few months.
Yeah. We've got one of the Gateways books that was penned by Peter David, but. Yeah, so kind of bummer, but yeah, if you're listening and you want to, I guess, honor their memory, maybe go pick up one of their books and read. I've seen people on Facebook doing that, so it's pretty good. But for now, how about we kind of move toward the night? That's the name of the book that we're going to talk with James about here in just a minute, and let's see what James has to say. Well, James, thank you so much for joining us once again. It's been a little while since you've been on the show, but welcome back to Literary Treks.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me back on the show. It's always fun to talk with guys where I know we're going to get right into the weeds. You should know the tiny little details. Yeah, that's always fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, we are as well. We've been really looking forward to having you on for this book. We've been waiting with bated breath for this book to come out for a while. And I guess just to jump right into things, and I think we'll probably, as we usually do, jump probably into spoilers pretty quickly. So, you know, the books, as we're recording this, the book has been out for about a month now. So hopefully everybody's had a chance to pick it up and read it. If you haven't, I encourage you to do so. But I guess, James, just to start off, this is really your first Star Trek novel since your CODA book, The Ashes of Tomorrow, which was released back in 2021. So I guess kind of how did this come about, getting into the Strange New Worlds world, and you know, kind of what was the genesis of this book?
I love Strange New Worlds. Really get that out of the way straight away. Yeah, you know, I've been enjoying the show since it started, so when the opportunity came down the pipe to do a Strange New Worlds novel, I kind of jumped on that. Absolutely. You know, grabbed it with both hands. And that all comes from our dear friend, Kirsten Beyer, who is, you know, former Star Trek Voyager novelist, now kind of official proper Star Trek writer over at Secret Hideout, working on the TV shows. She was the one who kind of tipped me the wink and said, like, you know, we'd like to have you come on board and do this. And that was passed on through our dear friend, the late Margaret Clark, who was my editor on this project. And they offered it to me. And like I say, I jumped on straight away. I was really excited about the opportunity to get hold of this group of characters, you know, because it feels like it's such a kind of throwback to classic Trek, to the original Star Trek that for me was my very first fandom, not just my first Star Trek fandom, but my first fandom of any kind. So it really felt to me like kind of going home again. To do this, and I was just had such a it's an absolute blast. That's a great time really working on this project. It's been so much fun.
There were a lot of classic Trek moments in this, a lot of tropes and themes that felt very much stuff from the original series that you might see. Did you have any particular episodes that you had in mind when you were writing this? For me, one episode that this really kind of reminded me of was Time and Again from Voyager season one. Did you have any episodes that were like in your mind as you were crafting this?
Well, the germ of the idea actually came from a conversation with an old friend of mine who's been a Trek fan buddy of mine since back in the 90s, where we were having one of those conversations where, you know, you kind of pick apart an episode and you're like, oh, what would you do if maybe this or that, you know? And we were talking about the Doomsday Machine. And there's a line in the episode where Commodore Decker talks about having left his crew behind on this planet to go off and fight the Doomsday Machine. And then the Doomsday Machine eats the planet and kills his whole crew. And it's this traumatizing moment for him. And we were talking about like that idea, you know, what would it have been like for those people on that planet just to see the Doomsday Machine coming and destroying them and having that kind of sense of like, well, this is it. Life is over for us. You've got no future. There's nothing. There's no way we could, you know, we could go beyond this point. And then the conversation was like, well, what if you could travel back in time and save those guys? And this was the idea that was kind of kicking her in. And I thought that's a really interesting sort of moral dilemma is sort of what would, you know, how would you deal with saving the lives of people who history says are already dead? Mm. What could you do with that? How would you play that out? And because Pike is such a morally centered character, immediately I thought this is a dilemma that I'd love to kind of connect to him, to see him sort of deal with that situation. And that was the original germ of the idea. So in an oblique kind of way, Doomsday Machine was an influence on this. But also, I would say very strongly, a lot of my favorite classic Trek episodes, stuff like the Enterprise incident, Balance of Terror, and stories like that. Just in terms of tone and texture, you know, me going back to the elements of Star Trek that to me have always been the most appealing, the combination of an interesting kind of thinky story and also some cool space battles and characters facing off against each other and having kind of flinty conversations. All of those sort of elements were all in my head. You know, I'm thinking I'm just drawing back on those, trying to stitch a new story that comes out of my favorite elements. I'm playing a lot of the notes from stories that have just given me pleasure over the years and trying to reconstruct them in a new and different way that kind of still gives you that classic Trek vibe, but in a slightly different sort of environment.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's definitely great, you know, well, seeing all the characters in here, but even like Pike, you know, being stuck in the situation and knowing what he knows about the future and kind of thinking, well, could this actually be the end, or could, you know, like, I feel like maybe I, you know, do I say anything about it or anything? So that was, you know, really kind of interesting to see him in that kind of, it's always kind of interesting, I think, to see Pike in that dilemma of these life and death situations, knowing what he knows, but then thinking like, is my future actually written? So, you know, even, you know, in reading a book like this, you still get that feeling of like, well, I don't know, are we going to diverge at all from, you know, what we know, or, you know, should we rest on, we know that Pike's going to be okay until sometime in the future. So
the interesting thing for me to play with that idea is that Pike has this foreknowledge, and the foreknowledge says, this is not how you're going to die. Mm-hmm. Every time he goes into a situation where, you know, he's on the sort of like the razor's edge, in the back of his head, there must be, well, this is, I know I don't die like this, so I must be able to get through this. But for him, as the kind of guy that he is, who's so strongly connected to his crew, the question becomes not will I die, but will the people I care about die? Because their future is still unwritten. Their futures are all still up for grabs. So maybe I might get through this. But instead of him being worried about himself, he is, as the true captain, you know, he's worried about his crew. It's how do I get my people through this? And that's a very different, you know, a very different sort of moral imperative that he has to kind of deal with.
You know, one of the things, too, I was really enjoyed about this book was the focus on Erica Ortegas, who, you know, she's gotten some spotlight on the show for sure, but we haven't gotten to learn too much about her. So it was nice to see her really get to shine in this book. And and also, you know, kind of a little bit of a theme for her of don't meet your heroes. You know, she's, you know, obviously meets someone who is a hero of hers, and it, as kind of usually happens, doesn't turn out to, you know, be what she expected. Was she always kind of, was she initially your focus? Did, you know, would, like, did you have any kind of direction to use some of the kind of quote unquote minor characters from it, or did you always have her in mind for this one?
For me, it was always at the origin, it was going to be a Pike Ortegas story, as they were going to be my primary focus, just because they're my favorite characters on the show. I mean, Pike, you know, as I said before, you know, he has that strong moral center, and it's really interesting to explore that kind of characterization. But I just really liked Ortegas as a character. I've always had a soft spot for kind of Top Gun pilots in that kind of story, and I've always liked her kind of cocky attitude, and I just think she's so much fun. And I felt, to be honest, that she hadn't been well served by the show, is that we did get a little bit of her here or there, but I really wanted to dig into her background. So when I pitched Toward the Night to begin with, I said, I want to really get into Erica's background. I want to play with some direct threads into who she is and why she took the choices that she did and why she became the woman that we see her in the show, and play to that idea of, yeah, like you say, you know, it is be careful what you wish for, but it's also it's never meet your heroes and it's be careful what you wish for. It's all those two things going on in her life. But we also get to kind of do what tie-in novels can always do best, which is where you take a character and you just unfold them a little bit. You know, we can't radically change who they are, but what we can do is we can shine a light on an aspect of a character that maybe the TV show doesn't have the time or the inclination to do. So for me, that was like, yeah, I really want to get into that with Erica's character. And the great thing was is that everybody at Secret Hideout was like, yeah, go for it. You know, they gave me the opportunity. And one of the cool things was, I was working on this project, I was seeing scripts for season three, because one of the things we originally were going to do is we were going to set the last two books, mine and Una McCormack's Asylum, were originally going to be set in season three. And for various kind of scheduling reasons, they were like, oh, you know, it's going to be better if we do it in season two. So we had to kind of move the storylines a little bit. So what that gave me the opportunity to do is, in a way, is kind of foreshadow some stuff that you are going to see in season three. And there are, if you know, there's stuff in the book right now that people won't kind of will miss, but maybe like in a couple months time when they've seen season three of the show, they'll go, oh, that was a cool forward. Is that actually a reference to something that you're going to see in season three? One of those elements is her brother, Beto, who is going to be a character who will appear in season three and have some stories about him. And so I put a deliberate little reference in there to her talking about him and her relationship with him. And you'll see that relationship on the show. So it was really great to be able to kind of lay in, bed in those elements that will kind of blossom out later on in the series.
So you not only get to do some traditional tie-in materials of unfolding information about characters, but you also get to introduce characters that you wouldn't always in media tie-in fiction, specifically with Ortegas's, I think it's grand aunt, Luciana. And that was really interesting because, you know, usually the rule is you're not allowed to introduce family members like that. But I thought it worked so well because she's, you know, she's so hesitant to reveal to Luciana about, you know, what she knows about her, but also she really wants to help her because she thinks that there's an opportunity for a future for Luciana. So how did you come up with how to include that character?
Well, I wanted to, you know, it is the primary beat there is that be careful what you wish for. Sorry. And I liked the thought of just digging into the background of Ortegas and saying, well, what made her choose to become a pilot? To go boldly, right? To leave everything that she knew behind and go off into space. And I like the idea of her having this character, this person in her life who has been this gravitational influence on everything she did as a young person. A lot of the choices that she made, this person that she lionized and, you know, this heroine of hers, who she never met because they were, you know, separated by age and time. So she has this idea in her head of this kind of mythological version of Luciana, the character of who she was and what she did. And she drew from that to inform the woman that she becomes when she goes to join Starfleet. And of course, the situation is when they actually meet in this kind of time warp situation, is neither of them are the woman that the other one kind of expects. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Luciana is not this heroic, noble character. She's quite spiky and she's a bit unpleasant and she doesn't really like Erica to begin with. And Erica doesn't know how to handle that because she has this whole kind of idea of the version of this character she generated when she was like a 12-year-old girl. And that character has always been that mythic version of her. And now she's confronted with, here's the real version of this person. How does she kind of consider the situation that she's in? How does she move forward? And how does she genuinely reconnect with this woman who she never really has known? And that for me was just really cool character, sort of great sort of granular character stuff to get in there and have those characters bouncing off each other in an adversarial situation where they eventually kind of come to find the finer points of each other and that relationship blossoms into something more positive. And that was really fun to kind of just describe that arc through the story and have these two women coming from two different places, but they're also very similar people at the same time.
Well, it's like, it's, you know, with the don't meet your heroes or whatever, it, you know, how Erica pictured Luciana as she was growing up and developing her own personality as she was, you know, growing up. It, you know, there is some disappointment if, you know, you're meeting somebody and they're not who you expect. But, you know, I did appreciate that. I didn't get the impression that Erica then ever discounted how she Erica felt about herself and all this, because she's still the person she is, and now she just has to reconcile who she thought Luciana was with who Luciana actually was. It kind of makes it, you know, it shows that it's not such a bad thing to really build people up in your mind, as long as you can then, you know, reconcile that in your own mind, like, you know, because of how Erica, you know, glorified or lionized, like you said, Luciana, we get the Erica Ortegas that we know and love from the show and everything. But, you know, that doesn't mean that Luciana's a worse person or, you know, a lesser person because of that. You know, Erica's just all the better for it.
Yeah. I mean, Erica kind of mythologizes this character, this woman that she's never met. And from that mythologization, is that even a word? From that kind of creation of that character that she has, leads her to become and make the woman she is, and the choices that she makes. And meeting Luciana and finding she's not that person, none of that takes away from the choices that that Ortegas has made. In fact, if anything, it kind of strengthens them. Because she, you know, she even articulates it in the story when she talks to Luciana. She says, like, you know, if you're not that person and you don't want to be that person to me, that doesn't matter, because I took what I needed from you when I was, you know, that version of you when I was a kid, and, you know, I made myself a better person, and you can be part of that or you can not, but I'm still going to be me, and I'm still going to be Ruth. And it's not like kind of Erica's kind of entire worldview collapses. Oh no, this person is not what I think. Oh, woe is me. It's like, no, because that's not who Erica is. She's the kind of person who, you know, in any given situation, I think she takes what's there and makes the best of it. And that to me has been a very true part of her character. So her arc through that story where she says, okay, you're not what I thought, but okay, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me feels true to who she is. And so it's a learning journey, not just for her, but also for Luciana, who never wanted to be somebody's hero. And in fact, as somebody who's kind of running away from her problems, running away from the life she had, she didn't want to ever be part of that. And so for her, she has to face up to the idea that, oh, you know, maybe I had a bigger responsibility to my family than I ever thought I did. And maybe I was wrong about what I thought about where I came from. So she has to deal with that situation as well. And I think at the end of it, the two of them have gone through this kind of like stark realization about themselves, but it makes them better people, and it brings them closer together. And I think that was really cool to kind of plot that arc out and have it all sort of fall into place like that.
So that seems to be the relationship between Luciana and Erica seems to be a microcosm of kind of the general plot, because you also have not just the two of them interacting, but you have the full crew from 90 years ago with the Baldwin, and then you have the current crew of the Enterprise that's been sent back, and the current crew knows a little bit more information. But then again, there's some information that they don't know, and there's, you know, they need some help. And so the dynamic is constantly shifting, where there's like this kind of agreeability that they have, and then there's this hostility when the old crew realizes stuff about the Enterprise crew with Lon, and then it eventually turns back to being more working together. How did you develop how the dynamic would work between the two crews?
Well, you hit exactly the nail on the head there. I'm a big fan of doing macro and micro stories. I love to do, and I love to read stories where the micro story reflects the macro story. So yeah, that absolutely was intentional, is that the Erica Luciana relationship is a reflection of the larger Baldwin crew, Enterprise crew relationship, where they go through that arc of like, do I trust you? I don't trust you. I trust you. You know, and that's the arc that all of these characters have to put together. For me, it was just really fun to create that, to have these two different groups of Starfleet characters who are about 100 years apart. So they're kind of within living memory of each other. And that to me was interesting, to compare and contrast the attitudes and the tonalities of what is kind of Enterprise era Star mm-hmm. Trek with Strange New Worlds era Star Trek. And while they are both kind of out on the frontier and a little bit reckless, a little bit rough around the edges, the attitude of the Enterprise NX-01 era, Jonathan Archer era characters is much closer to kind of our sort of attitude of things and a little bit more hard edged. Because they're still coming out of, you know, the sort of ashes of the eugenics war, and they're not quite as trusting, and they're not quite as open. And you've got the Strange New Worlds characters who, again, have also recently come out of the war with the Klingons, but they're much more open, they're much more optimistic. And so that immediately kind of like there's that disconnect between the two of them where the two groups are, you know, we are similar, we should be friends, but we aren't quite making that connection. And that kind of gap, that's where a lot of the drama happens, is these characters are trying to feel each other out and trying to figure out, do I trust you? Do I not? How do I move this forward and make sure that we all get through this in one piece? That's where the essential drama and tension of the story happens.
Well, there's almost a parallel then, too, with, you know, Kirk and Picard meeting in Star Trek Generations, where Kirk is kind of like, I've got my own stuff. I've already dealt with everything. You know, I don't want to deal with your problems from the future. Like, don't bring those to me. And it's fun. Yeah. Having the past and the present, or the present and the future, whichever, I guess, position you're looking at it from, you know, meeting each other, because I don't think we always think of how, you know, we would react, you know, or deal with somebody from the future meeting us, or us going back into the past, you know, because even though we're so relatively close in time by 100 years or so, we know from the Star Trek history, there's a lot that happens in that 100 years to kind of change, you know, Starfleet, the Federation. I mean, even just warp travel alone, you know, the Baldwin is shocked, I guess, at how fast the Enterprise can go or get somewhere. And so, you know, getting those dynamics between the two is really interesting. I think too, like with, you know, La'an specifically, you know, we've gotten to see a little bit of her dealing with, you know, her heritage, I guess, on the show. But I always want more, you know, with that, like, you know, why do we have this character named La'an Noonien Singh? And, you know, we got some in season two, you know, when we kind of met very young Khan and everything, but seeing this crew, the Baldwin, having such, I guess, animosity towards La'an just because of her name and her heritage, and her kind of similar to Luciana saying, hey, I am not who you think I am. You know, I'm not my name. I'm not Khan. You know, that was a, you know, a really, as a reader, fun thing to read, I guess, more of her internalization of that and how she's probably dealt with that her whole life.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to explore that a little bit, because we have seen that, you know, but we've always kind of seen it for La'an in the rearview mirror. You know, it's just like she's had that experience and it definitely formed and changed her, and it's informed the woman that she is. But when we see her kind of in the present, she's past it. You know, it's definitely part of her, but she's kind of looking forward away from it. So I thought it would be interesting to place her in a situation where she doesn't get to do that, where it's like, no, for these people, for you, it's in the past, but for these people, it's present. Even though for them, it is kind of a few generations, but it's much more present for them. And so when they, you know, they discover what her name is, for them, it's a shocking moment. And it's, you know, the kind of mouthpiece for this is the character of Rix, the medic, who had, you know, he says to La'an, you know, I was raised by the generation, my parents and grandparents were the ones who died in the eugenics wars, and, you know, they were traumatized by that, and that generational trauma has been kind of handed down to him. So he immediately, his hackles go up when he sees this name, and he's immediately like, you're an enemy, you're here to kill us, you're here to destroy us. And he can't disconnect from that. And La'an is somebody who's like, oh, I thought I'd got past this, and now here I am in this situation where I have to confront it. And she just doesn't want to be part of that. She just wants to kind of move on for it, but she can't. This situation will not let her. So she has to, you know, kind of just, you know, put her big girl pants on. You know, you want to talk about this? Right, fine, we're going to do this. I'm going to address it head on. Because again, that's exactly who the character is. She's not somebody who's going to shy away from this. She's not going to try and kind of hold it or remove. She's like, you want to talk about this? yeah, okay, I'm going to tell you 100%, this is who I am. And I am, as you say, I am not him. I am not Khan Noonien Singh. You know, he's like, I'm not, you know, I'm not, my blood does not define who I am. And a lot of this, and a lot of that is a theme that runs through this story, is that who you are is defined by what you do, not necessarily where you come from. And that read all the way through this story.
So we don't just have the stuff in the past. We also have stuff happening in the present with the rest of the Enterprise crew, particularly with Una Chin Riley, and also with the Klingons who show up in the book. And it was really interesting because I can't remember. Have you ever written like a Klingon versus Federation story before?
I think I might have done. I don't know. I mean, I've done plenty of. I love doing space battles. I always like a bit of classic Trekkie and pew pew. So yeah, I definitely wanted to do that. I don't know. You know, now I think about it, maybe I haven't. I don't think I've, done what we think of as the classic Klingon kind of braggart captain, sort of like, oh, we'll be destroyed now. You know, I again, it's, you know, I said at the beginning about how I wanted to go back to some tropes and themes from classic Tron, and that's definitely an impulse from there to have that kind of situation. But I wanted, I think that the thing I really felt like I wanted to do in the combat battle sequences with Una and Commander Bren, the Klingon commander, is I wanted to try and do a battle sequence that wasn't about photon torpedoes and phasers, but was about the characters meeting on an intellectual level and showcasing Una as a tactician, and showing her, rather than fighting her way out of the situation, showing her thinking her way out of that battle. Because the whole dynamic that goes through this situation is Una is trying in every combat situation she's in not to fight, to keep her hand off the gun and go, can we find a way through this that doesn't involve gunplay? It must be a way through it. And of course, the character who she's up against is the exact inverse, who in every situation is absolutely trying to go straight to violence. Straight towards action, straight towards, no, I want to start shooting fight. How do I make that happen? So because you have these two characters who are pulling in absolute opposite directions, immediately that becomes a fun story to tell. Because again, these characters are grinding against each other, one pulling one way, one pulling the other way. And again, that's where the drama happens, where that disconnect is.
Well, just like the strategy that we get to see, that again, like this is the thing I love about tie-in fiction too, is we get to be more in their thoughts and see things that we wouldn't necessarily get to see on a show. Because yeah, on the show, it's going to be more about just the space battle and the spectacle of it. But here we get to see them coming up with solutions that aren't necessarily going to start another war with the Klingons. Like, let's just send out a decoy. We know it's not going to work for long, but maybe it's long enough. And then putting, you know, Una in this position of, am I going to have to leave this crew behind, you know, on this planet, similar to what you were talking about before with the Doomsday Machine? And I mean, a little bit different reasoning there, I guess. But, you know, like, you know, on a show, we're not going to get that time to see the strategy involved. And like you said, like Una being a tactician and the crew working together to solve a problem, maybe not with diplomacy, but also not with violence or war.
Because Una's in a very difficult situation in this story. Is, you know, she's lost her captain and a bunch of her crew, and she doesn't know where they are. And she got her people working tirelessly to try and figure out, where are they lost? Is there any chance we can get them back? Or is this the end? You know, do I have to say goodbye to people who are really important to me? And at the same time, she's got this Klingon battlecruiser hovering overhead, this Klingon captain breathing down her neck, and a ticking clock. So she's in that situation. Do I stay and risk starting a war, or do I go and leave my friends to an uncertain fate? So not only is she juggling the kind of the tactical situation, but she's also juggling this kind of like emotional, moral question of, you know, well, I'm captain now. And if I'm captain, I might have to make hard choices that I don't want to make. And having her navigate through that situation, that to me was interesting, because it puts slightly different pressures on her that we haven't seen her do in the show. In fact, one thing I tried to do in this novel was I looked at a lot of the relationships and kind of pairings of characters that we'd seen on Strange New Worlds, and I tried to break them up a little bit. So I tried to pair up people who we hadn't really seen pair up before. And that's the reason why I wanted to have Una working with Dr. Mbenga, in this situation, because he doesn't really get to be a doctor in this story. He's actually kind of pulling on his skills as a veteran of the Klingon War, mm-hmm. because he's crossed swords in the past with this Klingon battlecruiser's commander. So he knows a little bit about her tactics. And Una says, well, you know what? I want you by my side. So he essentially, in a way, he plays the role of first officer in this story, because he's the kind of the person that Una is going, well, you know, here's my plan. What do you think? And he's like, well, she's going to react this way, or she might react like this. And here's my advice. And so they play a very much kind of like, it's a Picard Riker kind of role for those two characters in this story to kind of use those archetypes. And that, again, that was fun to place them in a slightly different situation. This is something that I always love to do whenever the opportunity arises. Take your characters and just push them out of their comfort zone. That, to me, is always where good storytelling happens.
We also have the planet that's here, which is the Gamma UFC 685. How did you come up with how all of the world building for the planet and its former people's culture, but also for how the science stuff around the timey-wimey stuff with the planet worked?
Yeah. Well, I was playing around with this idea of a planet sort of suffering this terrible kind of climate change, ecological collapse. And I thought what would be an interesting idea, this was actually something that many, many years ago, it was part of a plot idea I'd used as a story pitch for Star Trek mm-hmm. Voyager, which the pitch never got picked up, but I really liked the idea of this species who, for their own personal reasons, they didn't want to leave their home world because they were so closely connected to it. To them, the idea of like going off to other planets and colonizing other worlds, that was just anathema to them because they felt so closely, such a close kinship with their planet. But when this ecological collapse happens, they realize it's just going to wipe us all out. So how are we going to survive this? And the kind of the analogy is like a hurricane shelter, you know, is they just go, okay, well, we're just going to go down into the basement, close the doors and wait it out. But for them, this is like, you know, hundreds, thousands of years of ecological collapse. Is how are they going to wait it out? And so they build this device, which is essentially like a giant transporter buffer. And they all just kind of step through this gateway and it puts them into suspended animation. And they're waiting out this ecological collapse that's taking place. But a side effect of the use of their technology is what causes a problem for the crew of the Baldwin and draws in the Enterprise. And so our characters, you know, just by accident become involved in this situation that these aliens are in, and their technology that they've left behind on the planet ends up being the device that will allow our characters to kind of figure out a way to put time back on its correct track and hopefully, you know, survive.
Well, I like too that the technology, on one note, the technology really reminded me of the Iconian gateways a little bit. Like Jonathan and I are currently reading through the gateways series of books. And you know, where we're at in the series, we don't know if there's a time element to that, but like, I couldn't help, you know, kind of draw a connection there with the, you know, ancient Iconians. But, I really appreciated, that this wasn't an antagonistic, alien species either. That I wouldn't even necessarily say they were benevolent, but they were just, once the kind of main scientist, I guess, of the alien species met Pike and kind of understood their situation that they were in, basically invited them, like said, you know, like, I don't know if this is going to work for you guys, but you're welcome to try. And, I did like actually how that was just even sprinkled through the story, like kind of the mystery of this kind of, or the, you know, like that kind of trapped the Baldwin, but also just, you know, we get in the prologue, you know, kind of the end of one era for these people. And then we get to meet one of them and then we get to see how they come back to their world by the end. It was just nice to see kind of just this nice, peaceful people that they just love their planet and they just want to stay there. And, you know, they've ventured into space, they even say, but like, we just don't have any interest in that. And so it was just a kind of a breath of fresh air, I guess, as far as, you know, Star Trek aliens that we meet sometimes.
Yeah, I didn't want to create a kind of stereotypical kind of, you know, you people are invading our planet, how dare you, kind of, and immediately being a sort of like angry kind of adversarial situation. It's interesting that you say about the Iconian gateways. Yeah, that definitely was something that was kind of in the mix for me. when I was coming up with the concept for it. And also the Atavacron from Tomorrow Is Yesterday, if you remember that episode.
Yeah.
The Classic Trek episode, which is about, again, the similar idea about a species of who are escaping through time. In that story, they're escaping into their own past. But I reversed that. So in this story, these characters are essentially escaping into their own future. So yeah, I wanted to come up with a species that was slightly different. So I based them on bears. I imagine this kind of big earth sign, kind of like bear-like character. I thought that would just be interesting. Again, it's the sort of thing that maybe would be difficult to realize on television with a TV budget. Great big hairy bear-like guy, you know, with wear all over him. But again, it's that would be fun to do in a book. So yeah, I wanted to create characters there who would feel human in their own sort of way, you know, that would be relatable to us to understand, you know. Certainly, you know, climate change is a very real thing that a lot of us are, you know, in the world are suffering in greater and greater degrees. And so Star Trek has always been a story set up where we can mirror real world concerns. So that was definitely something that I wanted to kind of address there in this story. And then having them, you know, having that character Keel, the scientist, reconnecting with Pike as the story ends, I felt like that was something that felt, again, a real sort of Star Trek moment for me.
Well, and I think too, you know, you think about the risk that these people are taking too, you know, like they don't know how long, they don't even know if it's going to work, you know, as far as, you know, going through this gateway and waiting. I mean, for all they know, the planet could be destroyed. It could come get colonized. I mean, I guess I don't know that they were aware of other species out there. They just didn't really have any care for that. But, you know, I think just, yeah, having that and, like, you know, thinking about that species in the future and what's going to happen to them in the time of discovery in the far future, you know, are they, you know, going to, and I think, you know, we get to find out a little bit about that, you know, at the very end of the book. So it was just kind of this very fun adding to that timey-wimey kind of, you know, nature of this book.
Yeah, the coda in the end, originally when I was writing the story, I was going to have a coda set thousands and thousands of years into the future that was just going to have kind of Keel coming out and going, oh, well, everything's fine now. And the essential moment would be is that, you know, in their last meeting, Pike says to Keel, you know, I promise you we'll make sure that you sleep through all of this and it will be fine. And I, you know, Starfleet will look after you. And that's part of Pike as a person as well. Is he's the guy who makes the promise and keeps it. And I wanted to have that moment there. And then as I was putting it together, I was actually talking to one of my fellow writers, Dayton Ward, about it. And he said, you know, you could do something interesting with this if you match up the timelines. And then I realized, I thought, oh my God, I could make this work. And I said, hey, what do you think about, where could I put it? And he said, like, if you put it here, it fits between these two seasons of Discovery. And I thought, oh my God, this is a no-brainer. Why did I not think of this before? That's the perfect way to end the story, is to have this kind of stealthy kind of stinger scene, post-credit scene, you know, where he all steps out and it's the crew of Discovery who are there to make good on the promise that Pike made. And it works even better because Michael Burnham is there and she knew Pike.
Yeah.
So they have this mutual friend. Is that, you know, yeah, I know that guy, you know, and I'm fulfilling the promise that he made to you. The Starfleet promise is that, you know, we'll look out for you. And who knows, you know, I like to think, yeah, maybe those guys, maybe the people of Sekar joined the new Federation, you know, and a part of that now.
Well, and leave it to Michael Burnham who's kind of helping rebuild the Federation in the future to kind of keep an old promise, you know, after 900 years or whatever to, you know, we always see on the show, like, oh, we'll check back on you in a few years and then we never hear about this place again. So it's, you know, we're actually seeing the follow through of somebody actually making that promise.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like a Wrath of Khan thing. It's, oh, we'll just come back later. And it's like,
yeah,
no, you know, no, they did actually kind of, you know, Pike made the promise and Starfleet kept it. And I think that was important to show that, show the kind of, the kind of the ending of the sort of circle of those set of events.
Do you have anything currently that you're working on that you can tell us about that's coming down the pike from you?
Yes, but no. So yeah, there is some stuff I'm working on. I am working on a video game project, which is really cool, but it's in very early development stages, and I'm looking forward to being able to talk about that. I'm working on a new original thriller novel and a couple of non-Star Trek related tie-in projects, which again haven't been announced. So yeah, my dance card is pretty full, none of which I can talk about right now. Unfortunately, that is the lot of being a tie-in writer, is we have to sign all these non-disclosure agreements. We can't say anything about them. But so I'd say, like, you know, just keep an eye on my website, jswallow.com, and my social medias. And as soon as I can talk about any of this stuff, I will do. But right now, I have to stay zipped about it.
I would love to see more in the world of 24, by the way.
I did see your mug there in the back, yeah.
Yeah, I've got the books right behind the mug, too. So.
Yeah, I would, that would be fun to revisit that world, you know. But I don't know whether the option, whether the rights for that, or even who they're even with right now.
Yeah. Well, James, yeah. Anything else that you're dying to talk about this book before we let you go?
I just want to communicate to people how much fun I had doing it. Is that, I mean, for me, writing Star Trek stories is always like kind of coming home again. Because, like I said at the beginning, you know, Star Trek's my first fandom, and you know, and I love these characters and these worlds. I don't think there's any Star Trek I haven't even enjoyed. Even Section 31 had stuff in it that I thought was okay. You know, I have a deep abiding love for Star Trek, and so it's always a celebration for me to be able to come back and tell another story. And certainly, the amount of fun I had with watching Strange New Worlds and then getting the opportunity to kind of come in and have these characters to hand and play around with them. And I think because the characters are so well defined on the show and they have such strong voices and strong personalities, it was just so easy for me to pick them up and just say, okay, I know how these characters sound. I know how they talk and how they behave. Just having the opportunity to pick them up and put them in a cool environment and put them under pressure and have cool stuff happen. That for me was just so much fun. I've really, really had a great time with it. And I hope if people have as much fun reading it as I did writing it, I'll be very happy.
Yeah. Well, I know that I enjoyed reading. I think I read it over the course of like 2 days. So it was, it was just hard to put down once I got into it. So, well, thank you so much, James, for joining us today. And we really do look forward to anything that you've got coming out, but especially in the world of Star Trek, and you know, hope more of that comes your way very soon.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fun interview with James. I don't know. Neither of us have never met him before, so that was really cool to be able to meet another Star Trek author.
Yeah, it was. I'd never met him before, but I've been reading his books for several years, and he's a great author. He's written some of my favorites. Personally, absolutely love Ashes of Tomorrow from the Coda trilogy. But my favorite book of his is The Poison Chalice from the Fall series, which was just so good.
Yeah.
So
it's hard not to fanboy when we meet these authors.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's you know, I hope
we held our composure.
We did, yes. I think we did. We did okay, but you know, it's. It's really fun too. You know, we were talking with James afterwards too. He was just saying it's, you know, this is one of his favorite things to do is, you know, talk about Star Trek with people. And, you know, he gets the joy, I guess, of writing these books that we get to read, but then just, you know, knowing that he's a fan too. And he gets to just, you know, spend a weekend day, you know, talking about Star Trek. You know, it's just fun. And when we talk to him, it's just like talking with our other nerd friends, you know, about Star Trek.
Yeah.
So, So, you know, it's going to be a little while before we have a new one. I think David Mack's Ring of Fire is the next one that we get coming out later in 2025.
October, I think.
Oh, yes. It got moved from.
They moved it back.
It was going to come out the day after my birthday, but now it's coming out in October. Well, happy birthday to me. But in the meantime, what do we got coming up next?
We have the next Gateways book, Gateways number 4, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Demons of Air and Darkness by Keith R.A. DeCandido.
Yeah.
I've been really excited for this. I love Keith's books, and I'm really looking forward. I hope that it keeps the quality that the third Gateways book had. And not so much what the first two had.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely looking forward to getting into that one. And there is a previous Literary Treks episode on that. So if you want to go back and find that, this is probably, I think, the first time we're ever going to reread a book that's been talked about before. But I think it was, I believe it was Bruce and Dan that read that one together. And talked about it in the context of reading through the Deep Space Nine relaunch books. And now we're kind of taking it as reading through the Gateways books. So very excited to get into that one. And yeah, I mean, when you've got Jem Hadar and a Hirogen on the cover of the book, I think good things are in store for us. So.
Yeah, yeah. Should be fun.
But until we get to that, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you?
You can find me on YouTube. My Twitter or YouTube account is Jonathan Cohn. You can find me on Twitter X or Twix at Jonathan Cohn. And you can find my Goodreads, which is Jonathan Cohn. So keeping it very consistent everywhere.
Yeah, and you can find me on really Goodreads and Letterboxd are the only places I'm at Knitting Trekkie. And you can also find me poking around on Facebook in the Babel Conference. And that's about it. So
yeah,
thank you, everybody, for listening. And until next time, live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.